The money thing? Security? A nice house? I guess that's important to some people.
No, it's not important to some people, Robbie. It's important to all people.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. Greg, I read this stuff and I wonder what the hell kind of world we're in. SP Futures up 17. NASDAQ Futures up 84. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning.
Kevin, just when you're even more convinced you don't want to live in Florida, after the SpaceX thing blew up yesterday and rained debris down on people, just another reason you don't want to be there. Hurricanes, and one of our friends, he's all pissed off because he can't get his private jet into West Palm because Trump's there all the time. He's got to go up to Juniper, wherever the hell that is. It's just very tough. Living in Florida.
Yeah, life is tough. Life is very tough.
Yeah. How does somebody who has a space thing blow up on March 6th and there's supposed to be a big investigation get the approval to send the thing back up again before the incident report is even filed and blows up again? They had to stop traffic at Miami, Lauderdale, West Palm, a bunch of places. I don't think this stuff hurt anybody, but you probably want to stay at a house for a little while. What the hell? How do you not even put the incident report in and you put the thing up there and it blows up again?
I don't know. Tell me the story about it, because I...
Well, this is this big racket that they think is going to go to...
But what happened? Did it blow up on reentry or...
No, it blew up on the way up, I guess.
Oh, it blew up on launch.
Well, no, it was moving.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't know where they take... I'm not sure where. I'm not sure if it took off at Canaveral or where it took off of, but it says here, briefly halted flights at several Florida airports on Thursday after a SpaceX Starship testing failure. Incident marks the second time this year that a SpaceX experienced a mishap, blowing up, I guess that's a mishap, during a flight test of Starship result. This is the one that's supposed to go to the moon and into Mars, right? This is big sucker. Affected airports include Miami International, which is an American Airlines hub, airports serving Fort Lauderdale, West Palm, and Orlando, Florida. The regulator said in a statement it is now requiring SpaceX to perform a mishap investigation of the loss of the Starship vehicle during launch operations on March 6th, which evidently is not in. Anyway.
Well, Carl just chatted that he can talk about it if you want. Carl, you should jump on.
Yeah, here's what you need. Maybe Carl's...
All right, I can do that.
Carl, are you in the debris response area? What the hell is that?
Oh, well, no, that's... when you shoot something up into space, of course, it covers an arc on the way up, right? If it blows up in the process of departing the Earth, whoever happens to be in that area gets treated to a shower. And the vast majority of the pieces they burn up in the atmosphere. So, I mean, it's very pretty fireworks display. But some of the larger chunks can make it all the way down to Earth. And that happened the last time. There were, few pieces found in people's yards and things like this. And I don't think there was any damage done to anybody from the last one that blew, but what probably this is actually kind of an interesting failure, because there's what Elon's trying to do is figure out a way to have reusable top pieces, okay, the actual business end of the rocket, if you will, that carries the payload. Now, of course, we learned how to do that with a shuttle, right?
Sort of.
Well, yeah, but he's, Carl, he talked about this at length last week on the Joe Rogan podcast. They're trying to do, because we have figured it out with the shuttle, but they're trying to do rapidly.
The idea
is that the shuttle takes months to be ready to go again, because they haven't come up with a way to have a reusable heat shield, as an example.
Well, yeah. Well, it's not that it's not reusable. It's that every single tile must work. Okay. Yeah. That if you
they're
lose one,
they're trying to come
one,
up with some kind of different tile.
Well, if you lose one or it gets damaged, and you launch a second time with the damaged one, then the plasma gets into the ship and blows it up on reentry.
That's a bad thing.
Well, yeah, that's a bad thing, especially if you're inside it. So, I mean, that is how we lost the second one, in that a chunk of foam came off the tank, hit the wing, damaged some of the tiles. There was nothing that could be done, and because there's no way to fix it in space. And so once that occurred, everybody on the ground knew that everybody inside the shuttle was dead. And it was, you know, you could either die of asphyxiation when you run out of oxygen, or you could attempt to re-enter, and it was almost certain you're going to die on the way back in. But what he's trying to do is come up with a design where he can turn these things around inside of a day. Now, that means you have to be able to inspect and fix whatever it is that gets damaged, you know, instantly, all right? That's really, really tough, all right? I mean, you really can't have more than, you know, like one or two in non-critical places that are damaged and have to be replaced and be able to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, because if you incinerate it, it's really, really hard to inspect it.
Department of Double Talk Department. During Starship's ascent burn, the vehicle experienced a rapid, unscheduled disassembly.
Yes, this is what they.
In contact. What does that mean? It blew up, right?
Chief, this is what people in space exploration and rocketry call a screw up.
Okay. An unscheduled disassembly. I
got to remember that term.
That's unreal.
Yeah, the common term for this is it blew up. Okay. But what it looks like, because I looked at the video, so they got the separation. There's really quite a thing about managing to separate the booster and the second stage without destroying the booster, because you have to be able to break them apart, and then when you light the rocket in the second stage, if that exhaust destroys the first stage, it's obviously gone. Now, if you're not trying to reuse the booster, it doesn't matter. But in this case, they are, and they got the separation. The booster successfully did its deceleration burn, its reentry, came back and was caught in the chopstick thing that they've got at the launcher. Okay, so they got the booster back. But after that, the ship started to spin uncontrollably. And at that kind of speed, you're still partially in the atmosphere. It does not take much, okay? And it comes apart from aerodynamic forces. So my guess from what I saw, and that's all it is, because I don't have the telemetry data, they do, is that they went to shut the engines down and one of them didn't turn off.
What's the scratch loss on something like this? How much money is this thing worth?
A lot. I mean, you know, probably $1 billion went up in smoke. So, I mean, but now the thing is that they have yet to have one of these actually perform as expected fully from one end to the other. Okay, so this is, you know, this is the second very similar explosion The last one failed kind of sort of the same way, or at least looked that way from the ground. Whether or not it was the same failure that, you know, you'd think probably not, but the same sort of thing. But what blew it up was not actually the ship detonating. What blew it up appears to have been aerodynamic. All right, in other words, you know, I mean, if you yaw something at that kind of speed, the aerodynamic forces just tear the thing apart. So the other one, what I heard was that it looked like from the ascent profile and from the video, it looked like they had a propellant leak, and that got lit.
Well, anyway, this thing took off from Brownsville, not from Florida, so it was gaining serious altitude by the time it made it to Florida.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it was well through where everyone kind of expects the biggest problem is at max Q, which happens about a minute after the launch, and that's maximum aerodynamic pressure. That is where you are still relatively low and therefore, you know, pretty thick air, and you're accelerating very rapidly, and that's, there is a point in time when you go through that maximum aerodynamic pressure. That is where you find out all about structural integrity or lack thereof. And they got through that without any problem. That was during the original boost, and then shortly after the separation, everything went to hell. So,
how did we manage to get the Saturn V up in the air like 60 years ago? That thing was as big as this thing, wasn't it?
Well, actually, the Saturn V is considerably, it's in terms of lift capability, is smaller. And that's, boy, there's all kinds of interesting aspects between the two. All of the Saturn V rockets were bespoke. You could not take an engine out of one of them and put it in another one. The flanges wouldn't line up.
Really?
Yeah, they were hand-built, and they were all bespoke. You got to give this guy credit where credit is due. Elon has taken what used to be a entirely bespoke thing and essentially made it into a Model T. Okay, where everything's on an assembly line. You can take an engine out of one of these boosters and put it in another one, which by the way, they do. If they, you know, they see something in the data they don't like in one of them in one launch, they'll yank one of the engines out and put in a different one. So there's
The engine has double the thrust.
Yeah, it's, well, and it's a huge number of engines as opposed to, you know, you've got in the original boosters, the Saturn V were very few but very large. These are a lot of and much smaller. And the problem, you know, there's trade-offs in both of that. If you have, you know, 30 engines, how many of them can you have not work and still get to orbit? Well, the answer is you probably can lose one or two of them and you still have enough thrust to be able to, you know, to complete the mission. And the Saturn V, if you lost one of the original engines in the first stage on liftoff, you were screwed. Okay, all you could do is hit the abort tower and, you know, get the capsule clear of it, because there was no way it was going to manage to make orbit. Now, they did have, in the second stage, they had one instance, in Apollo 13, they had the inboard engine that shut down early. And they still had enough thrust in the other four, because they still had all the fuel, of course, to be able to, you know, to make that that orbital transition. But, you know, it's there's a trade-off, because obviously if you have, you know, a whole bunch of engines, there's a whole lot more of, you know, one of them can break, right? If you have fewer engines, there's fewer of them.
Well, it depends
break.
On your tolerances. If you design a 4-engine aircraft where you can fly fine on three, it flies fine on three. If you design it so you need all four, then you got a problem.
Well, right, but I mean, but the idea here being that, you know, these are easier to replace. They're assembly line components as opposed to bespoke components, and they're designed for rapid reuse. The theory being the booster can be refueled and fired the next morning. So, you know, I mean, this is some pretty
some
pretty handy stuff.
We had a class at the Notre Dame. Did you ever take space tech, Kevin, or no?
Oh, of course.
Did you have we had Dr. Nicolades. Mike was in a class with me, Mike Murphy, and He was the head of NASA for a while, this German dude. Or I think he was German. The original shuttle was, they had pictures of what it was supposed to look like. It wasn't supposed to look like anything it ended up being. The shuttle, let me rephrase, the shuttle is turned out to be the shuttle. But it was supposed to take off on some, essentially, Boeing 747 on steroids that would fly the thing up, you know, really high, let the thing off, sort of like they did the X-15 and the X-1s. It would take off from there, and the other thing would just fly back down. And you'd be ready to go that afternoon if you refueled it.
Well, yeah, the problem with that is the math doesn't work.
Well, not only that, I'm not so sure it didn't, but they said it was going to be too expensive, and they had more trouble with that than they did with the shuttle, and then they cut back to the solid fuel rockets, which was a really horrible idea. But this guy claimed after several years into it that if they just would have moved on with the first one and worked through the problems, it would have saved them a lot of money over the shuttle, not to mention a couple of crashes over the shuttle, whatever, history or whatever.
Well, maybe. I mean, there's a basic problem with chemical propulsion, which is one of the reasons that Elon's screaming about Mars is just, it's a crock of crap. And that is that every pound you wish to lift into space requires propellant. And the propellant has mass. And so you have to have enough thrust when you start to establish a positive acceleration moment. In other words, you need more thrust than you have mass, okay, at the launch. As you burn up propellant, the thrust that you impose gives you more delta V, more velocity gain, because you're accelerating less mass. The propellant is being consumed. The problem with this is that, and this was the whole thing with Apollo, you couldn't carry enough propellant to slow the craft back down and get back into orbit on the way back. The math did not work. You could not carry enough propellant in the ship to be able to do that because you couldn't get it off the ground. Okay? Now, this is the big issue that you're going to have trying to do other than one-way kind of things, you know, put things in orbit, whatever have you. But if you think this is a simple problem to solve,
oh, no.
That's why
you have to bounce into the atmosphere and damn near burn the thing up if you don't have a heat shield.
Well, Chief. So you can't carry enough propellant, for example, today. There isn't any way to do this with chemical propellants. You can't take a rocket into space and then decelerate using a burn and actually slow down enough that you don't need the heat shield. You have to use the atmosphere as a brake. The math does not work any other way.
Well, the only way you could do it, and some people have thought about it, is essentially the space station becomes a gas station.
Well, you could, yeah. Now, that's what Elon is talking about doing, which raises a whole bunch of other problems, is essentially throwing tanks up into Earth orbit, launch, refuel in Earth orbit, and then do the transfer orbit to Mars.
That's what I'm saying.
That is not a trivial problem, though. Transferring fuel
yeah, that would be tough.
You have to learn how to populate the dilithium chamber.
Yeah.
But yeah, you got to give credit where credit is due. He's doing things that people have not done before.
Just had some warp speed, we'd be okay.
Well, yeah, you know, if we can figure out how to, as long as we're using chemical propellants, we have some very serious challenges trying to do anything beyond Earth orbit.
Well, how do the UFOs get here? Everybody knows that when they get here, they just wait for a lightning storm and recharge and go back. Everybody knows that.
Oh, yeah. Everybody knows that's how it works.
The way you do it is you shrink space-time in front of you and you expand it in the back.
Yeah.
You cheat.
Yeah.
Is the short answer. Now run the math. Now, by the way, that's part of theory of relativity that works. Now run the math on the energy requirement for it. And get back to me, because that was one of the things that...
That's why you need the dilithium.
Well, that's right. Myself and my nerdy friends, we figured out the the energy requirement to do that when, like, we're talking like high school years.
God, that's where the antimatter comes in, you know.
Well, if you can figure out how to generate a star or two,
yeah. Well, some of the stuff made sense. If you said antimatter,
I will say this: that you, I would really recommend that anybody go fish out the conversation with Rogan. Because there is a really, I mean, if you don't want to hear about Doge, you know, just space past that. If you don't want to hear about, what the hell else does he have on there that's pretty substantial? It doesn't matter. Listen to the part about space exploration. Whether you think he's full of crap, whether you think he's right or wrong or nothing, it's a really, really interesting conversation. And a lot of ideas out there. And, you know, trying to lay out time frames and so on. And if you really like this kind of, you know, really geeky stuff like that, it's kind of cool.
Well, the issue there is if we're never going to essentially get warp drives and all the other stuff, where are you going?
I mean, well, chemical propulsion is a dead end for anything beyond the Earth and the Moon. And that, and I understand that people would like to think it not, and you know, that they've got these ideas that they're going to manage to pull, you know, this off or that off. But math is math, and physics is physics, and you know, I mean, you're not going to violate the laws of physics. So there is a real problem with trying to do this with the technology that we have available to us today, and frankly, I think the breakthrough, has to come at a much more fundamental level than just sticking rockets together and figuring out how to refly them. You
know, well, they were. This guy, and Nicolades, was absolutely convinced that the original shuttle idea would have worked with something to get it up there and then pull it back down.
The problem with that is that, and essentially what they were trying to do was avoid that first. That first bit of getting out of the, you know, out of the gravity well from the ground,
right?
Okay, which is where the problem comes from, because the amount of propellant that you expend and the mass of it that you have to carry at the launch point, just to get the first few thousand feet of altitude and get a decent speed going, is unbelievable on a percentage.
Well, it's like taking an airplane off the ground. In a sense, you burn up how much of your fuel the first 10,000 feet?
Well, not nearly as much as you think, because you're getting aerodynamic lift. See, that's the thing.
Right.
That was what they're trying to leverage, is using aerodynamic lift with the wings of the plane, as opposed to the products of combustion.
Well, the problem with the solid fuel for those is maybe too technical for some, but the
can't stop it.
The once you turn it on, it's like one of those things you put in your car. If you if you get caught in the side of the road, you light it and throw it out there. Well, you can't turn it off.
Well, once you light it, yeah, the entire grain burns, whether you like it or not.
And that's what caused the people to die in the shuttle and going up.
Well, no, what caused the people to die in the shuttle was that the people that launched it were stupid and fired outside of the safety windows, and they knew it.
Well, but I'm saying that if there was some kind of a sensor where you could have shut the thing off.
It would have made no difference, Chief, if you'd shut it down, and that once that burn through had happened, they were dead.
Yeah, they were in trouble. They went up at 40 degrees. It was supposed to be 50 or something.
So the basic problem is that the boosters had to be made in sections because they were too large to manufacture at one time. So they were made in sections, and they had at the joints they had a set of O-rings to seal, but the gases are so hot that there is no compound known to man that actually can maintain that seal, all right, against that heat. So the design is that when you fire the thing, the pressure, the spike of pressure, forces the O-ring into the channel, and that's where the seal comes from. That's how O-rings work, and that has to happen before the hot gases get there. So what's actually creating the seal is much cooler gas and the pressure from that. If it doesn't seal and you have leakage through there, the 3,000 degree gas will get to the rubber, and when it does, it's going to burn through it.
This is the rubber in the solid fuel racket.
in the seals between the sections.
Right.
And so basically the design is that, you know, obviously things get stiffer as they're colder, right? The design is that at a, you know, if it's too cold, then the gases will get to the seal before it forms, before it completely compresses into that groove. And if that happens, you die.
Wait, how fast are they going when they do that? When they're going pretty fast.
Well, the seal forms within the first fraction of a second when the engine's fired. Okay, but if it doesn't, because it's too cold and the O-ring does not get completely compressed into the groove and cut off the passage of all gas, if there's any leakage, you're screwed.
They were what, Carl? They were like 20,000 feet.
Yeah, they got the beginning of the burn through happened instantly. Okay, so
right.
And the problem is that once that starts, there's no way to stop it. There's nothing you can do, and you're gonna die because it's gonna burn through the outside of the casing.
But they didn't know if they were not able to jettison the command module for some reason.
Well, you can't cut a burning rocket loose. It'll hit you. I mean, you could jettison the boosters because there are explosive. I mean, that's how they're jettisoned after you're done using them. Okay, there's explosive bolts under.
Well, you can't turn them off. That's where I started the conversation by saying.
Yeah, you can't turn them off, and if you jettison them while they're going, they're going to strike your craft, and you're
going to. Or they're going to go somewhere. They're going somewhere.
You're
going
to get incinerated one way or another. Right. Exactly. So I mean, that's the thing is that there's that's the thing with solid rockets is that once they light there's just nothing you can do about it. They're burning all the way to the end one way or another,
sort of like a torpedo. Remember that you killed us.
Yeah, well, they knew the thing with the shuttle with Challenger was that they knew from previous launches they had pushed the limits of those of the temperature specifications. And when those boosters, they came back in and splashed down the ocean, they recovered them. And they knew from inspection that they had been very close to have, they had like one of the three rings had burned through. And so they knew that like, okay, guys, look, if you do this, we told you not to do this. You did it. You got away with it this time. That doesn't mean you will the next time.
Yeah, okay. They did.
And this is the problem with, you know, shaving safety margins. You're playing around with things that, I mean, you know, rocketry and nuclear power plants and things like that really don't go real well with.
Well, you know, stuff is over-engineered. It's kind of, when they were, they had all these guys that were fixing the L-tracks near my house. And one of the guys who was working on it comes in, I don't know where I was, sitting there, probably having a coffee, but maybe more like a beer. And a guy sits down next to me, and he's working on it. And I said, everybody knows that this thing is over-engineered, and if you're missing a few rivets, it doesn't make any difference. He goes, you're absolutely right, except for one thing. I go, what? He goes, there isn't a guy that can tell you exactly how many you could be missing.
That's right.
We all know you could be missing a few. We don't know if you'd be missing 10 or 15 or 20. Nobody's willing to give you that number.
Well, that's exactly right. Is you can play with the margins, but they're there for a reason.
Well, you do know that the stuff that was built 100 years ago had a higher margin because people didn't. I mean, I remember.
We didn't have computers, and so you know, I mean, it's like you look at the Hatteras yacht that I had, the bottom by comparison to the thickness of the fiberglass compared to the stuff that's built today was like double. Okay, and of course, this meant that it was slower. It also meant that it was essentially bomb-proof, right? Whereas with today's stuff, if you hit something that's partially submerged, there's a pretty good chance you're going to put a hole in it. And glub, 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 glub.
Yeah. Well, I remember the guys at Pullman telling me we had all these old factories, so you could actually pick a railroad car up by the overhead crane and move it. And they were trying to... take the crane from 20 tons to 30 tons or something along those lines. And I go, well, what do you got to do? You got to put a whole new, you know, me being a dummy, you got a whole new thing of steel up there? He goes, no, it has nothing to do with that. He goes, it's the control. Your controllers have to be stronger. He says, but those things, when you built something in the 20s and 30s, if you had a 10-ton crane, it could do 10 times that in a one-time lift. I mean, you couldn't do it all day. But right. You could do 10 times. He goes, then it went down to 4, now it's like 2. So right. If you have a 10-ton crane, you could maybe lift 20 tons once. But then, yeah. but the other, these the old ones. It could have been 100. You know, they just. What's the difference? They just over-engineered everything.
Well, the difference is if you try to do it the third time, it may drop the load on the guy underneath.
Yeah, that's a problem. You have a railroad car drop on you. Hey, Carl, while we have you here, well, we're going to have you in a bit, I'll talk to Kevin for a bit, and then you come back we got the labor stuff. It's a big day.
Yeah.
What'd you make of this? We have Greg as well. The 78,000 contract trade in the 10-year note futures. Did you see that yesterday morning?
Yeah, you know, there's a bunch of things that this is the market is screaming at me about at present. You know, I watch this TNX IRX spread, right? And you know, I've talked about it a bunch on the show. A few days ago, it went back into inverted land. It is now barely, but at this moment, it is positive again. This trade. Is first off, of course, you don't know if it's a hedge or if it's a speculative bet, right? You do not know the intent of the person who placed it.
Okay, just backfill here a little bit. 78,000 contracts. Every contract is $100,000. Is if you buy one future in the 10-year note or in the 30-year bond, it's $100,000 is the baseline.
Well, that's the margin requirement.
But well, no, $100,000 is that's the size of the bill that you're trading.
Oh, so, I got you. So okay.
78,000 times 100,000 is $7.6 billion is the notional value.
Yeah,
trade.
It's a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And that's the notion. The thing is that the value of the contract. I mean, you know, people talk about the notional, but it is the probability that the actual value of that contract will ever be zero.
Well, but if it goes down a buck, you're down $1,000.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's the way you got to look at it.
Yeah, exactly. That's how you have to look at it. So, I mean, but the thing is that this appears to be what I read is correct, this is a bet that we're not going to see a collapse in the long end that everybody thinks is going to happen.
Well, somebody could conceivably. Again, the weird part of this is it happened as a block trade in the London hour before it even opened here. So. Right. And then, would you say, Greg, they only deflected the market 4 ticks?
Yeah, it really didn't do much.
No, and so if somebody, I mean, we've seen the 10-year rate go down, which means if somebody would have bought,
well, you give up like that was they gave up probably
$20 million.
Yeah, more probably.
Well,
like,
at that size, it's what $5 million a tick.
Right,
right.
That's a number.
Yeah,
but if somebody, and I know somebody's not going to be one of us, it might be Kevin, you know, but. It's probably either some huge fund or a country that maybe bought a bunch of 10 years when they were lower, and now the rate has gone down a little bit since Trump has been in.
And they just trying to hedge.
They just might not want to hedge the whole thing, and you can deliver all kinds of different 10 years on the delivery.
Well, you can deliver bills against it, right?
Well, I used to get when I was on the Board of Trade. I had the badge, but I never traded the treasuries. But every month back before computers. You'd get this big stack, a big brown envelope, with all the million different 30-year bonds from every different time they
went
out for.
They're probably up 100-some million right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they have the underlying, they're down on that, right?
Right. Well, but that's the thing. You don't know the intent of the person that did it, right? Is that you don't know if they're sitting on a huge position and they're saying, uh-oh, this is going up and we're going to get pounded, right? The coupon's going up and we're going to get pounded. Or the other way around is it a pure speculative play? You do not know that whether they're holding the asset and trying to hedge it or what the intent is. But what it looked like to me is that essentially it is a transaction that says we do not believe in the premise that the Trump administration and the Treasury are going to be able to contain the long end of the curve.
I don't think they will. But what about the guys? But there's also two sides.
Someone took the other side of the bet.
What about that guy?
They got out.
They're out?
They got out. That's why the market moved when they put the
thing on. There's still another. The other side's open because they didn't close.
No, the open interest went way down.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, that's interesting.
The thought was maybe they were gaining lots of deltas via options, and then they put put the hedge on with futures.
It could be.
That's possible.
Well, you're not gonna do that naked. Unless you're a Treasury Department somewhere.
A few of the big hedge funds in London do have that kind of cash, and they've been known to do that kind of stuff. So it's Brevin Howard being one of them. Maybe Rokos.
Well, good for them. Obviously the thing was shopped and brought to the floor, so everybody probably had a chance to do something beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, that's not something that you do from a trading console as a retail guy.
No, that's not a... Right, hey, Kevin, while you're on here, when did California get in the ACC? Our girls are playing them today, right?
That was all part of the off-season stuff where California and Stanford are in the ACC. I really think they need to work on the name of the conference. It is no longer it stopped being the Atlantic Coast Conference a long time ago when they had like Notre Dame and Louisville in it. But,
well, I got an easy one. How about the Both Coast Conference?
Yeah, well, the Coastal Conference or something like that would work.
All Coast Conference, something.
California's I saw them play California at home.
There's no upset so far. There was one slight upset, right?
Well, yeah, there's always some slight upsets in the early round of a basketball tournament. Sometimes some blockbusters. I would say Louisville last night winning was a bit of an upset only because their best player Jada Curry was out for the game, and then they still managed to eke one out in overtime against a pretty good team. Now's when conference tournament gets serious. So, we'll see how it goes. And I know we probably talk because of you and me, we probably talk more about women's college basketball than you would get in most places, but that's because our alma mater has a really good team and a really likable team.
Well, it's also, I think it's more than that, Kevin. There's an amazing difference, and Carl and I have talked about this as well. When you open the floodgates on the NIL and stuff, the different, I won't say directions, but the different outcomes of what's happened with the women's basketball versus the men's, I think is absolutely fascinating. I mean, the men, obviously, the schools, I think, are paying, alumni are paying, and because there's a lot of money in the NCAA tournament and so forth for the school. The women, on the other hand, are kind of doing it sort of on their own. They're staying 4 years, most of the time. They're making a name for themselves. They're getting kind of their own deals. They're able to be on commercials and seemingly not just the girls from Notre Dame.
They're getting the school money too, Tom.
I know, but I don't know if there's as much. But my point is,
go ahead and finish your thought.
What you find is a lot of these young ladies are terrifically marketable. They look good. They talk good. They actually, you'd love to have them talking about your product. I don't know if the guys necessarily have made those sorts of inroads. Some have, not as many, I don't think.
Well, I just think in my own experience. Dealing with 18 to 22 year old guys and dealing with 18 to 22 year old women, I think the women are they're more mature, they're more thoughtful. Excuse me. I heard an interview years ago with Gina Auriemma at Connecticut, and of course at the time Connecticut had both a powerhouse men's team as well as women's team, and the interviewer asked him if he would ever want to coach men's basketball, and he said, "No way." He said, "When I'm coaching women, I don't worry about getting the call from jail at 2 a.m. I don't worry about who's academically ineligible. Those are not my problems. I just worry about coaching my players." And I think you get a different quality at that time, but you're also right about them staying for generally 4 years because the WNBA does not allow them to draft early, so they have to. They can leave 1 year early if they turn 22 the year of the draft, which in many cases, which is less than half of the cases of the star players. But otherwise, they're there for the long haul. So they develop identity. The teams develop an identity. The stars get increasingly marketable while they're in college, and I think that that does a lot for women's college basketball. Nevertheless, you still see that the popularity isn't the same. There was a game on last weekend from Florida State, and Florida State's got a really good team, and yet there were more empty seats in the stands than full seats in the stands. Places like Notre Dame or Connecticut or another handful of places that sell a lot of tickets are rare, and in Notre Dame's case, part of that reason is that the tickets are dirt cheap. So I have a pair of season basketball tickets, and they're really good seats, and I pay $150 each for them for the season. Well, that gets a lot of people into the arena, and really it always has at Notre Dame. It always has been way less expensive than the men's team, even though the women's team is generally better.
And yeah.
Well, there have been years when the men's team has been really good too, and they will draw. But the arena is populated by a lot of seniors. A lot, like as I think I remarked to you once, at age 70, I might lower the average age of people in the stands. And part two of it is that then there's also a lot of people who will bring their families. Well, you can afford to bring the kids, and you're not paying $40 a ticket to bring the kids in.
How would you rate at the end of the season, as we pile into the tournaments here pretty soon for the men? I watched the game the other night. The Irish played Stanford. Of course, in somebody's genius, they played at 9 p.m. on a rainy night. Was there 1,000 people there?
I didn't go.
It was just vast.
I didn't go.
I watched the game last night. It was a men's game somewhere. It was a couple of pretty good teams. The whole second balcony. We didn't even have everybody up there.
Well, what they're doing, Tom, is we're playing Stanford. Back on the West Coast, that's a 6 p.m. game.
Well,
so they're time slotting the games for the ACC network. So there's an early game, there's a 7 o'clock game that is just East Coast teams, and then there's a 9 o'clock game featuring Stanford or California or somebody like that. And there is no, maybe on a really nice night at 8 o'clock, I would have said, okay, I want to go to the game. And I would have gone ahead, but it was cold and rainy. By the time I walk across the parking lot, I'm miserable. It hasn't been a good season for them, even though it was a good game for them and a really nice win for them on a late shot. And I was happy with that. I had it on TV. They still kept me up past my bedtime. But yeah, it just wasn't worth the trip to me.
Well, but there's a lot of these college games. I'm kind of watching. I'm trying to get a feel. I've been watching more college games, maybe because we talk about it, than I used to. And you'll turn on a stadium like Duke, which has a small stadium, and all of a sudden the place is overrun by students and everybody's going crazy, and I don't know how you even get a seat there. Then you'll turn on somebody else, and it's a school is, it's not Duke, but it's a good-sized school, and all of a sudden, there's some student groups there in one section. They always manage to find them on camera. And you'll see there's, the place is half full. If you had to judge the health of all this stuff, how would you judge it compared to 2, 3, 4 years ago? I mean, I have no idea.
It's hard for me to say because my live experience is a program that's trying to write itself. So, the thing is to understand, and I'll use Notre Dame as an example, but I suspect that a lot of football schools are in this in the same boat, and that is that the way you market the two sports is completely different. So for football, what do they count on to fill their stadium? And they don't fill it 100% of the time anymore, but what they're counting on is that there are a whole lot of alumni who are gonna, that no matter where they live in the United States, they're gonna make the pilgrimage back at least once a year, and then a lot more who will go more frequently. Those people are going to buy their tickets over the summer because they don't want to make the trip for a big game, especially unless they know they're locked in on tickets. So they'll pay a lot of money for tickets, and then they're going to make the, you know, the plane reservation, the hotel reservations, and all of that. So the tickets generally sell really early, and that's a whole marketing scheme that's built around that event. On the basketball side, these games are played sometimes at 9 o'clock, but usually about 7 o'clock on a weeknight. You're not going to get people traveling for that from out of town. You're not going to get people who come from, you know, Grand Rapids or Toledo or any place for a game, most likely. Occasionally I have some people who will come in, or they'll come in for a game weekend or something like that. But by and large, people aren't traveling. So you have to market that locally. And you see how that works really well for the women, because they're not only marketing it locally, they're making it really cheap entertainment for people locally. So when you're going through a winter in South Bend, you know, the best things to do in this area are all outdoors, and they're not out, they're not wintertime events. So basketball is a good market. I don't think they figured it out very well for men's, because it's not just my season tickets. I think they're a good deal. I've spent, I want to guess somewhere in the $350 to $400 a seat for the men's basketball tickets, but so I think they're a good deal. But at the same time, that's not how they sell the single game tickets. So mine average about $20 a seat. The same seat sold as a single game was probably $40. Well, who's going to take their family of four out for $160? Who can afford to do that? And then try and bundle in something else, like, you know, concessions that are god awful expensive, or anything like that. And I'll give you one more little bargain thing. They have this club up at the top of the stadium, and they're trying to rethink it, because I don't think it has been a smashing success for them, because they've always priced that expensively as well. And so for women's basketball this year, they said, heck, if you want to just have access to it, it's $25 a seat for the season. $25 for me to go in on a game like last Sunday's game at Louisville, get there real early so I don't have to fight the worst of the traffic, and hang out, you know, up in the lounge and get myself a Bloody Mary. That's a pretty good deal.
Well, we had
a $25 for the season deal. All it is parking my butt in a place to wait. But still, it's a much nicer place to wait than I'd otherwise have.
Well, for those of you who aren't stuck in the Midwest, when we first graduated, but afterward, I was trading on the trading floor, and, you know, our buddy Dak, not Dr. J, other Dak, says, "Hey, why don't we split basketball tickets?" We did it for like 3 years. We ended up, I don't know, we ended up with a box seat. We had like great seats, because every year they moved us like 20 feet closer to the center court. And we said, we're doing the math, right? Okay, they got the games are on Saturday. You know, we'll go to a couple of those. We'll go to those. And the night games, I mean, you get off the trading floor at 3:15. So the games with the time change were 6:30 on our end. I said, okay, Doc, we get out of here at 4, which we can do pretty easy. We get down there, have a sandwich and a beer, watch the game, and if we beat feet out of there, the games don't take that long. We're back home here at 10 o'clock. And so, you know, we can do that twice a month. You know, we were young and strong. And Kevin, every single time, this is from Chicago, every single time there was some sort of weather event or some crap, finally one night the toll road was closed because they had about 8 people killed in some cross snow drifting sort of thing. We had to take US 20 home. We get back like about midnight. We go, screw this. And we didn't get anymore. We're not doing this anymore. But I mean, we tried, and but it's, you know, it's hard on a winter night when you're driving around in the Midwest.
Yeah, it's a difficult sell. So how are you going to market the program? And it really has to be built around getting butts in the seats. I don't think, I mean, sure, there's money to be made marking up the tickets, but I think you do better creating atmosphere by having a lot of people in the stadium. And the real money that's associated with the program is from your conference TV rights. So, you know, do that. And, you know, I've talked to people in the athletic department. They have not embraced my brilliance, but I get to try every once in a while. It should be a very inexpensive seat.
We even seem like we're kind of messing with the student body. They're not even there all the time.
Well, students are an interesting issue because I'm convinced that students, that this is a generational thing. When we were in school, you know, we and damn near everybody else in the place was a sports junkie.
Yeah.
And so we just didn't miss games. We went to games of all kinds.
Well, I went to every hockey game because the hockey players lived in our dorm. But hey, Ken, we have a few minutes. What?
Let me finish the thought on that, yeah. and then we can take our few minutes. So, students today, I think, like big events, but much more than they like the sport itself. So if we're playing Duke or we're playing, you know, some other big name school, the students are there and they're waving their arms and having their signs and doing whatever they can to get on ESPN, and they are there. But if it's not, if it's Wake Forest or somebody like that during the week, they don't care. They're not interested. And to me, following a team for over the course of a season, the fun of following a team over the course of the season is watching every game, watching it unfold, and seeing how things develop. There's a whole story of the season that I think goes untold if you just cherry pick off a few games.
Well, we didn't. I never missed a basketball game. I never missed a hockey game. Nobody missed a football game.
Yeah.
But hey, in terms of what the market's doing now vis-a-vis the politics of the world, which, you know, depending on where you're at, good, bad, but they're different, and it's shaking the market up and down, and it always rankles me when different people make announcements during the day that can move the market back and forth, and I get this awful feeling that they just made a trade before they said that, but that's kind of been there through the generations, although it seems like it maybe is getting a little worse because everybody thinks everybody does it. But if we had our friend Petra back on, where they're at the Hull Trading, they try and put this model together where they look at trading statistics and all the other stuff in the market and try and add stuff from the outside in there to try and...
Is your business being challenged by the complexity?
What are you doing over there, Greg? He's cutting me off, but what... I don't know. If you were in charge of those outside inputs, Kevin, what the hell would you be putting them in now? I have no idea. How could you be quick enough on this stuff to try and figure out what outside... It reminds me right now in terms of outside influences on the market, like the first Iraq war, where everybody just had their eyes glued against the oil futures, and oil futures ran up, you figured something bad happened, and you bought puts. And I mean, it's kind of nuts here to try and figure this out. I mean, it's nice.
I would think so, because, I don't know what the right word is to describe, you know, how fast and frequently the news is coming out of this administration. Mercurial is not quite the right word, but it was the first one that popped into my mind. There is just always something going on, and the pace, it's actually pretty entertaining in its own way, but
there's
a pace of what's going on that, and I don't know how people are keeping up with it. I'm guessing they aren't. I'm thinking there's a whole lot of trading mistakes to be made based on that.
Well, I found that we have, and you know, Audrey was saying the other day, I said, you know, this is kind of crazy, and she goes, look, you're the only one around that has seen markets like this. You're going to have 6 months of this chaos. You're going to do really well. Just hang with it. And you know what? I hope she's right, but it's because of our kind of hedge stuff, Kevin. We've been able to make some really good trades because we're already not 100% one way or the other. Sort of like the people Greg was talking about with the people with this trade in the... if you've already got your calls and puts lined up because you know this trade's coming down, then it's just icing on the cake. It's not even really a trade because all you're doing is completing it. But I don't know what you could possibly... We have people that trade, you know, here on their own. A lot of people at PTI, they use the IB platform or whatever, and, you know, we don't... Sometimes they call if they need some help, but most of the time they just do it on their own. And you can see whole styles of trading, like I'll use the buy to dipper style of trading, which was never mine, but it's been basically the style of trading for, what, Greg, 15 years now? Every time the market went down, you just bought it and held your nose and went out for beer and came back, it was up. Well, we've got a bunch of those people that are buying these dips every day, and they're not having a good week or two. I mean, it may turn out that it'll turn around and and they'll be fine at the end of the day because that's what's happened for the last however many years. But, or you can sense, I'm sensing a little bit of a tone change, Kevin, in the sense that, you know, the deficits, all those kinds of things, seem to all be coming together. And we predicted this, and I know Carl was on it, we predicted this quarter, this half of this year, a lot of this stuff was going to come home to roost, no matter who was in office. And it really didn't matter what policies somebody had. They have issues to deal with. And, they just do. I mean, and I don't know if that's part of what the market's seeing here. You see what's going on in Germany. Now, the question was, and I'll ask you, I'll ask Carl when he comes back in. The whole thing this week is the DAX. We've talked about it. The DAX has been up all week. Well, not today. It's getting its ass kicked, but it's been up all week. Now, the idea is Germany is going to they're going to expand, their economy. They're going to an expansion mode. Okay, but how does Germany do that? Because the European Central Bank controls the money supply, not Germany, right? So they can't just print necessarily from Germany like we can here. So sure enough, yesterday, European Central Bank lowers the interest rate, which means they're going to start putting more money into the system. Now, is that going to cause an inflation event over there, or nobody cares about that because now there's more money to spend on tanks and whatever the hell they're going to spend it on? I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on here that all sort of comes together, doesn't it?
Yeah, I wonder how much the notion of cutting back government spending is an acknowledgement of some of those forces that are coming home to roost, because that's such a big contributor to the inflation numbers. I know a lot of it is for inefficiency, a lot of it is for wasteful spending, all of those kinds of things. But, you know, shouldn't that really be a factor in, just as a straight-up economic policy, that and there's a whole, replacement aspect to it, where we're saying anything that we cede to government means it's not getting done by the private sector. So, and which also means it's not getting taxed or anything like that. I don't know how all of this is going to shake out. I know that the things that are happening are a little bit different for a change. For a change for better or for worse, and we've argued about that in the past. But I'm wondering, how does all that factor into what's going on in the economy, or will factor in, fairly short order, because, it's just this big jumbled mess of all this stuff, like you said, is going to come home to roost, and we've been talking about it here for a long time. And me being a pessimist anyway, a perpetual pessimist when it comes to the economy, I'm thinking there's going to be hell to pay. I wonder how much of that can be offset somehow, some way.
Well, I just wonder when people go through the math, and it's unfair, even though I do it at times. I accuse the government kind of at all levels, doesn't matter which side they're on. If I had to do anything with them, before I give them a slap in the face, like if it was, what was it, Aquavelva, what you need is a cold slap in the face. Before I give them anything, I'd almost give these people a calculator, Kevin. Because it seems like nothing. Now, if you lay somebody off, which the number seems to be, all in, it's about $120,000, vacation and all the other stuff, right? Per person. It's a gross, but it's not really, is it? It's, they're going to be paying taxes on 30 or 35% of that, right? So you're getting some of that back.
The government number, yeah.
And then if they can't get another job, now you're going to pay unemployment. And what are you really gaining? I mean, and there's,
well, but you are in a,
oh,
lot,
yeah, sure,
of
you are, sure, you are.
First of all, there is the displacement. So that we know there are a lot of jobs and open and available in the private sector. So many of those will get filled and then will become taxpayers again. So that's part of your equation too. And I don't know how you model this.
The rapidity
but
of
the
it.
The other part to understand, and I think I've mentioned this before, there is a cost to just having people in your employ. There is just all kinds of crap that goes with that, and it's not necessarily bad, it just is. You're going to spend money having computers. You're going to spend money having, bathrooms and toilet paper and paper and telephones and telephone expenses, and you know, you start piling on everything that goes with having a person on there. And there's a fair a sizable chunk. It's not as much as the salary, but there is a sizable chunk of money that goes with that too. And when you start rolling it all up, because you're not accounting for that just by saying salary and benefits minus unemployment.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, there's this whole other stack of stuff.
But it also starts from
It's travel expenses that people have. You can just start going on and on and on. Think about everything that you have that you do every day that costs PTI Security some money, and I think you have to put that into the equation too. Plus, it's management attention that goes in there, and it's not necessarily management, and it's leadership attention that probably could be directed into something more productive.
Well, as you know, you and I have gone back and forth on the idea, whenever you have a person working somewhere, by the way, I don't normally do this, but I went for one of my, I've been fascinated by them putting I-40 back together. There's a couple good things on YouTube. So, of course, I get on there, and I got some liberal dude on there, and to me, he's just as nuts as the people on the other side. But he's talking about his interviewing all these 2- and 3-time Trump voters that just got laid off, and how outraged they are. Like, I never thought he meant me. Like, you know, duh. I mean,
you know what? He's,
but you know, the thing is, I think nobody.
He shouldn't have thought that, because he said what he said during the campaign. He's not doing anything he didn't say he was going to do.
But
they knew what they were voting for. They just. You know.
Well, when somebody says as much as this guy does, it's pretty hard. But I guess what I'm saying, Kevin, is there, you and I think, even though we argue about it, would take a slightly different approach. There's a lot of jobs in the government that, you know, it's easy to go into a bar and have somebody say, like, no, nobody does anything there, fire all the assholes type of thing. I mean, and I could say, based on the time we needed some law enforcement help, I got none. So I could easily say, hey, the 5 people in the Justice Department I met with, and all I did was, after a 2-hour meeting, tell me they weren't going to do anything. Well, I didn't need them in my employ that day, did I? I mean, it's real easy sort of to do that, but we have, you know, we've had a lot of people that come through PTI in terms of clients and so forth. I know at least a couple, Kevin, that both of them were daughters, that they were in school. Their goal in life was to work for the Center of Disease Control. I mean, that's what they went for. And one of the guys, I think you probably met him. He used to live upstairs from me. His son, nice kid, good baseball player. He somehow did something with the forestry department. He's in love with the place. He ended up going to some college, and now he's doing forest management someplace. These are kind of singular. These are jobs where people just love what they're doing, and they're actually. I mean, they're not everybody's the schlump walking around a post office that everybody talks about. I mean, there are a whole lot of people that really, I mean, Bill Moriarty talked about all the people who work for the highway departments in the states and the government, because these people, they know their crap. They work all day. I mean, I don't like, somehow or another, some people have gotten the message that everybody who works for the government is useless, and I that's not the message. You don't feel that way. I don't feel that way.
Not a new message, by the way.
What?
Not a new message.
Well, I know, but it seems like somehow now they think they're going to get this big savings from it, and nobody is. I mean, you and I know where the number is, and when Carl comes back on, we'll talk. We know, somehow or another, we have to worry about this medical stuff, and we got to worry about those kinds of things. That's where the big issues are, right? And are we going
to
get there or not?
The way it has to be rebuilt, and this, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with Department of Education, but. You know, the NIH and, you know, all of the health agencies have the same thing. Just forgetting the philosophical things. We don't pay for outcomes. We don't pay for success. We pay for maybe for activity. We pay, you know, for some oversight. But there is a difference between, let's just say everybody works, everybody intends to do well. Well, there's a whole difference between effort and results. And right now, we ain't going to getting results in a lot of areas. And that's what really needs the look. And I think a lot of that is, you know, because I've seen it in the business world. I've seen what happens when you get bloated. You don't get the results. It's funny that, you know, when you are operating lean, you get results. When you're not operating lean, you get worse results when you think, well, I should at least get some little bit of marginal bump from all my extra spending, and that's just not the way it tends to work out.
We got to get back to Carl, but I was talking to some guy the other night, and he was saying, the IRS, for instance, he goes, I've had some issues with my return. When I call somebody, they're there. Everybody I know gets a return in like a week and a half because it's way better than it was 15 years ago. Why do we think everybody there is a schlump? He goes, to me, every time I've talked to somebody there, they've been pretty darn good and pretty and addressed my problems. I mean, why do we not assume that there's some people doing something?
I honestly don't think that there is that assumption in the current administration that nobody does anything. And in fact, you know, the way they're, you know, the way they've structured this DOGE thing is that they, you know, the people who are in charge of cuts, the people who say yay or nay to the cuts, starts up at the top, and but it's in the individual departments. It's not like you have Musk going around and firing people. They're just providing data. And different departments are approaching this differently. So as an example, Director Patel said, you know what, don't worry, DOGE, I got this. I'm going to let me work it. And so they have. They've stayed away. Then transportation, they said, come on in. Let's, you know, please, we need you to give this a really good look. So, you know, everybody's taking different approaches. There's not one universal approach to this. And, you know, I think it's important to, you know, to have a grip on that as well.
I think so, too. Just when you can't have all the people in the Consumer Protection Bureau, which was not my choice in the first place, that place, and at the end of the day, two of the people are family members, and you find out you just saved 0.0001 of the federal budget, you sit there and go, boy, I thought we were doing something better than that. I mean, the numbers are, there's a lot of numbers around, Kevin. I'm not so sure that's where not that they shouldn't be doing it, but it's not, you know, it's not where the numbers are, unfortunately. Most of the money the government pisses away goes to people outside the government.
Yeah, and I sent you that one NGO example, you know, about the six people being fueled out of one big funding grant and who they were. I think that's where the biggest money is right off the bat. There will be some money to be saved in people. And again, this is the kind of thing, though, that when you're looking at bloat, when we're talking about bloated staff, this is the kind of crap that goes on, because one, you get people who are looking for, you know, things to do, ways to go. You may have, you know, a certain amount of a certain amount of more than a certain, there will be malfeasance, but I think, as you're looking at it, what you're really saying is, and I'm trying to pull up the article while I'm talking, so I'm sorry. The idea that that you have funds going out the door. We talked about this before to an NGO. Somebody's going to stand up an NGO for a few million bucks, and then they're going to get all of a sudden, you know, $300 million in funding from the government.
Yeah, right.
And it's really just an extension of the government. I think that's, you know, that's what you're doing, is it's almost like this little shadow part of every department.
I would agree. We got to dash over to Carol, Kevin. Away,
then I think we'll be in better stead.
How do you suppose by Tuesday, or by whenever, I'm agreeing with 100% on the DOGE stuff, because, I mean, he's out. Hey, I've had people tell me, what are you doing managing money for people? All you gotta do is get a lunch contract at the jail and you're set for life. I mean, I don't have a feel for whether it's worse than it's ever been, it's the same, or it's, I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's always been there. I mean, that's not an excuse.
Oh, it has always been there. Yeah. It has grown. I've got to fish out an article for you that I'll share out about the explosive growth in NGOs.
Okay.
It's just become the scam.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that's where it is. And then we see it in other aspects too. So, for instance, you know, we go back and we talked about this at the time in Ohio when they were talking about eating the cats and dogs. That the real scam there was the number of immigrants who were placed in manufacturing jobs by NGOs who were skimming out, who were putting them there at a below market labor price, forcing others out of work, and in the meantime, they're skimming off their share of what of the substandard wages that the immigrants, the undocumented immigrants, were paying. And so, you know, this is part of the NGO scam. Is they're not, you know, they can call it a not for profit, but somebody's getting that money.
Well, there's always seemed we got a dash to cover, but there's a remember. Actually, I think Carl, if you want to pile on, we talked about this. I talked about it with Carl. I know a couple of times where when Hurricane Katrina came by, it introduced. They didn't call it the NGOs in those times, but they called it. The big scam was subcontracting, remember?
Yeah. Well, Chief, this is the problem, is that the whole concept of America is capitalism, right? I mean, that's
to certain people, it means different things. To me, it means competition. Other people, it means if you're not cheating, you're not trying.
Well, right. So from my point of view, as an entrepreneur, right, and, you know, is it means competition, okay? By the way, competition... One of the most efficient ways to have competition work, it requires that the government stay the F out of the way when somebody makes a mistake, all right? Because, a major part of why I can sit here and I can trade and talk with you guys instead of having to get up and go to work today is because other companies did stupid things. They blew up. And I was able to take advantage of the fact that they blew up, and therefore I was able to get office space at a fifth of what it would have otherwise cost me. I was able to get hardware in a couple of instances from companies that blew up that if I'd had to pay full price for them, it would have cost me five times as much money. All right. And that all went into the cost of providing the services and goods that I sold. Now, but the reason that my margins were where they were was certainly to a significant degree my ability to exploit those things. Why? Because I had capital available, because I was frugal, I was not in debt up to my nuts from a bunch of bank loans, okay? And so I had cash. And so when those opportunities became available, I was able to waive, you know, the leasing agent at Prudential Plaza, I was able to wave a big check under his nose because I'm this little runt company. How's he know I'm going to actually pay, right? He leases me the space. How's he know that I'm not going to basically screw him and you know, I'll pay the first month's rent and I never pay again, right? And how long does it take for them to throw me out? No, I sat there and I waved a six-month rent check under his nose. And he says, well, how do I know that's good? I said, well, you call the bank.
Well, you mentioned...
yes.
Well, you mentioned a word here, and the two words now that I think... Well, I'm not going to make it a main theme of the show because it'll bore the hell out of everybody, but I mean, I keep coming back to this defined profit in today's world.
Right.
I'm also going to say defined competition in today's world. But now, in my story about the subcontracting, which is now sort of the same thing that Kevin's talking about, the competition for the Katrina jobs, for lack of a better term, rebuild or whatever you want to call it, didn't happen like you and I, the three of us might say, here's what we want you to do, bring in your bids.
Right.
Well, that's not what happened. It was who the hell got everybody to hooker in Washington or wherever the hell they did.
Chief, but this is, you know, the same thing happened. We had the service contract for one of the major library systems, the North Suburban one in the Chicago area, okay? And they got a package price on places that couldn't be served at the time. There was no cable. There was no such thing as cable modems. It didn't exist. So we had a bunch of smaller libraries, branch libraries, where the only viable way, I mean, we could bring dedicated lines in there, but they couldn't afford to pay for it. And they just didn't have the budget for that. So what they had was a modem and either a terminal or later on a PC, and they had dial-up accounts. But here's the thing. I could sell you a package of 200 of those, but they're all billed on one invoice. There's one point of contact. There's one person that calls our tech desk if there's a problem, or a customer service desk if there's a billing question, whatever have you. So I have a much lower cost of servicing that one account that has 200 connections than selling 200 retail connections to 200 people. All right? My costs are lower. Now, all of those are pretty much on the human side of the interface, all right? I mean, I still, for every one of those connections, I still have to have a modem on my end. I still have to have, you know, the storage space and all of that, right? But in terms of, you know, any business has a customer service component to it, all right? I mean, you know, you go into Home Depot, there's somebody there at the cashier, you know, at the cash register. And if you bundle those things together, yeah, I can offer you a really attractive price compared to the onesies if you're buying 200 of them.
Right, but there's kind of degrees of graft, and it's very difficult. I talk about this
all
the time.
Well, there are, yeah. Chief, but see, this is the thing, is that then after a while, what ends up happening within government is that they come back and they, you know.
They keep changing. It keeps changing is what
I know. But I'm saying, you know, they came back to us and, you know, we had the Chicago City contract for a while, and then the city started playing games. All right, well, you know, we'll pay you in 90 days instead of in 30.
Oh, yeah.
Instead
of in 30. You're lucky in 90. Right?
Well, but the point is they started playing that game, and my answer to it was I went back in the computer room, I pulled a line card out of the chassis and tagged it and said, you don't pay, you know, I'm going to treat you the same way you treat me if I don't pay my parking ticket.
Yeah.
All right? Well, needless to say, when the contract came up for rebid, They had a whole bunch of additional things they demanded, and I told them to take a hike. I said, go put one of my competitors out of business. I'm not interested in this. And so, you know, but that's the way competition works. The problem is government.
That's what I'm saying. Try and figure out how it works now and always has been with government. It's a different.
But well, government doesn't. Yeah, they don't do things that way though.
Well,
Chief,
it depends on the. There's a certain morality. You're not going to be able to get the law to chase after people. People have to have a certain morale. I honestly believe this. And I mean, I don't have a... I keep saying World War II. If you and I and Kevin had a contract to do PT boat engines and we knew the right people and we got 5% more than if the bid was actually really what the bid should have been, I guess it's not right. But it's also... The money we're going to make, we're going to spend the local buyer. We're going to pay people maybe a few extra shekels than they deserve. It's almost like a little bit of grease. But if you get to the point where what happened at Cortina is the contract was so absurd that you and I would go to another guy saying, "Hey, how much for PT boat engines?" And the guy goes, "Well, 100 grand a piece. Well, we just got 200." And say,
right.
"Okay, you build it, and we don't even touch the damn thing."
But so, Chief, you take a look at like what Biden was doing with these fiber, this supposedly rural internet connectivity stuff, okay? And Elon said, you know, make a bulk purchase on Starlink dishes, all right? And Biden said, nope, gotta be fiber, gotta. All right, well, listen, I wrote an article on this. Last year, I drove up through some extraordinarily rural areas, all right, because I was hunting fall colors and, you know, fun stuff like that, right? So I get off the freeway, and I'm doing back roads in a part of the country that I know really well because I used to live there. And so I don't need, you know, I don't need Google Maps to tell me how to get where I'm going, right? But I'm going down these county roads that are, you know, they're two-lane county roads. And everywhere I am, as I'm going by all the telephone poles, there are coils of fiber cable that have been pulled and are just sitting there. They're not connected to anything.
But they're ready.
But they're all over the place. And they're, and I mean, I'm talking about, you know, like, if I could extrapolate. And this is probably unfair because I'm not sure that I just, you know, that I did just hit a lucky spot where that's where.
Well,
it was.
Yeah, it could happen to be.
That could happen to be, but I mean, I wasn't looking for this. I was doing other things. I was trying to shoot pretty leaves, right? And yet I found this the amount of sunk cost that was not actually connecting anybody to anything. Because this fiber was sitting on a pole coiled up,
Well, I'm not ready to give half the country's access to information over to Elon Musk.
Well, now wait a minute. It's all okay. So you'd rather give it to somebody that
what about Dish?
Tom, we also have this thing called 5G that's also not wire based.
Well, yeah,
or at least the backbone is, but access is not. And so it could be just as well be, you don't have to go to Elon Musk. You can go to T-Mobile. You can go to AT&T.
Chief, you can buy a box.
Stupid question. Hughes and the people that comes in off the regular Dish or DirecTV Dish, is that horrible or is that okay?
It is. So the whole reason that Starlink makes sense to a large degree is because Hughes runs off geostationary satellites.
Okay.
Which are, instead of being 100 miles up in the atmosphere, you know, just outside the atmosphere, 150 or so to be out of the, you know, the air, they're at 22,000 miles. So, because that's where you have to put them in order for the orbit to be geostationary. So the satellite stays in the same place relative to you on the ground. Therefore, the equipment just points at it. Starlink is a phased array, so as the satellite moves, it moves the signal where it beams it.
Okay,
in both directions.
Get it.
Right. Now the Hughes system does not know how to do this because it works off geostationary satellites. The problem with that is there's only so many slots you can have because each of them stays in a single position. There's only one orbital plane that works for this. And on top of that, the delay, the latency up and down.
We'll try and watch, try and If you're at a ball game, try and watch cable. It's 10 seconds late. Yeah.
There's a lot of delay, right? Now, for gaming or something like that, it's completely unusable. But the other issue that you run into with this is that the way they get around this for web browsing is the box on your end keeps a cache and keeps a lot of information locally. So if you are just browsing the internet, this works reasonably well.
Okay.
If you are trying to do anything interactive, it does not work well at all.
So not for gamers.
Well, it's not just that.
Not for podcasters.
Oh, really? Okay.
Not for podcasters, not for anybody. So, like, the stuff I do, the once in a while I do some contract work every now and then. I haven't done any in the last year or so, but I used to do a fairly decent amount of it. And when I moved here into Tennessee, there were homes that I would have liked to buy. Starlink was not yet available. I could not get terrestrial connections, and Hughes is unusable for the stuff that I do. It's completely unusable.
So regular Dish is the same thing as Hughes then, right?
Yeah, but it's worth zero for me.
All right. That's why I asked the question.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Okay. Now, in the last few years, there have been changes to this. So now you can go buy a little box from T-Mobile if you're in a 5G served area.
Yeah, but how many people in the middle of nowhere have a 5G area?
Well, you'd be shocked. When I was driving around up through that part of the country, in virtually all of those cases, my phone had a good 5G signal.
Really?
So
yeah,
there was
being rapidly built out.
Yeah, so there are multiple choices. Now my daughter has a box that you pay for on a yearly basis. It ends up being about $50 a month, okay, when you amortize it out with taxes and everything else. And it's unlimited 5G data.
Well, the girl downstairs supposedly has that too, and she says it's terrible.
Well, guess what? Well, it depends on where you are. Okay, now, Sarah also has borrowed my Starlink. I have a mini, all right, that I could turn on and off as I wish. So I don't have to keep it on all the time. But if I'm traveling, you know, if I've got my trailer or whatever, I can turn it on and use it. And the thing is, the difference is that anywhere that you can see the sky, that thing works. So she can sit out in the middle of the desert at Moab, which she likes to do.
Really?
Okay. And she can work from there.
Don't they have like snakes and stuff out there?
Oh, there's all kinds of interesting stuff, but it's really pretty. And, you know, I mean, if you like backcountry camping, there you go. But the thing is, there's no 5G signal there. Okay. So she had been out there before with the other box. And what she'd have to do when she had a shift is drive into town, okay, and sit in the van and do her shift sitting in someone's parking lot where she had a signal. Now she can sit out there and just put the thing in the dash, you know, up in the dashboard and turn it on.
And drain the battery.
There's a point to all of this. I want to make it so that I can turn you guys over to the BLS.
Mm-hmm.
the article that I had found was about the a $27 billion program that was part of the Inflation Reduction Act called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. Right. And what happened is all of that money got funneled to a whole series of NGOs that are former Obama and Biden administration employees, right. You know, executives and so on. So that's part of the grant. Now, that's the same thing. If you, let's just say we all agree that that we need to do something about greenhouse gases. And the thing is that when you can solve a problem, call that a social problem. I've got a good example for you about Walgreens and their South Carolina distribution center developing their systems and their process all around the ability for people with handicaps to work just as quickly and productively as people who don't have handicaps.
By the way, you know they're being taken over by they're being taken private today, Walgreens, just by the by.
Walgreens has its own issues, but the point of this is that 40% of their workforce is people with handicaps. Guess what? You're brought in, you're embraced, you're made to feel that you are every bit as valuable as the others. You're not a charity case. You're expected to work at the same pace as everybody else, but you're never leaving because that's the only place around that is going to treat you like that. If you just take 40% of your workforce and say, there, I'm going to cut my turnover by 80%, the cost benefit to the business is huge. And so Walgreens has started building out all their other distribution centers using all of the same techniques. The point being, you'll grow. If you have a solution to a problem and you can do it in a profit model, it'll grow. It'll get more funding. If you do it in a government model, you're going to be limited by what you can pass through Congress, what you can tax people, which doesn't seem to have a lot of limit, but it has some limits, and all kinds of other things. And if you do it in a not-for-profit model, you're limited by the donation money. It has to happen in a profit model, and this is one of the reasons to get government out of a lot of this.
All right, we gotta go to this other stuff. We'll talk about that, Kevin, because it's the same argument I have with Hal. Once you get involved and do stuff, we don't have a whole lot of competition. But by the way, I got a story for you later in the show that you're going to love. You'll think I crossed the aisle. I heard some story last night with some ladies doing some research. I was absolutely stunned. I mean, what the hell are we doing this for?
+151, 4.1%.
All right, now none of the people laid off lately are in this number, though, right?
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah, all right. I'm looking at. I've got. Let's check between the adjusted and not adjusted.
I gotta scroll down here because I just
The January number, like you said, is the crazy one. I've got 500,000 less people working in a household. I've got another 500,000. We don't know what they're doing, and I've got 150,000 in unemployment. Unemployment up to 4.1, correct?
Unemployment 4.1. Yeah. Let me key these figures here. So 162,544. So 197,000 is the raw, unadjusted increase in employment. So where's all these doji cuts, right? I mean, you know,
the outlier here, and you, how is the term, waxed eloquently last month, even though nobody understood what the hell you were talking about, Carl, because it's. This January number, what I'm looking at.
Well, the January number was nuts.
Anyway, we went from 161,661, now this is on my thing, to 163,895. So that's like 2.2 million people. And that's what you were talking about, you know, the January number is this big adjustment number. Now, almost 600,000 of that has come out on this. What does that mean?
Yes and no. So here's, again, coming off the unadjusted, All right, so the 12-month delta in employment is 2.229 million. However, that's down from 2.697 last month.
Last month's the weird one, it looks like.
Well, it is. So about 450,000 of that craziness disappeared in February. But the trouble, and again, this is this is a number I've been watching for a while, and I've been talking about it for a good long time on the show too. The labor force adjusted employment number, which is the one that matters over the longer term, because you know you put people into the system, and then somewhere you know something happens to them, right? You need those people to be actually working. They need to be employed. And we are now neg 2.907, almost 3 million on a 12-month run rate. That's the difference, the delta between the change in the population and the change in the employed. The employment population ratio went up by one tick last month. So that's, you know, that's in the correct direction.
This thing has it down too.
Well, again, I'm computing it off the non-seasonally adjusted numbers, okay? I'm not using their figure off the tables.
I'm not, because I don't know what their math is like, but I suspect your and my math means if I compare this February to last February, all the adjustments should pile out. Now, I'm not saying they
do. Well, that's the reason I use 12 months.
Okay, yeah. So if you go back to last February, I've got us up. We got 5 million more people around. Okay,
right.
I've got essentially 2.3 million more working. I've got 2.4 million people. We don't know what they're doing, and I got 500,000 people employed. So, based on the last year, less than 50% of the people that have joined the potential workforce
are working.
Are working, and the number is down from 60.1 to 59.9.
Well, and on an unadjusted basis, last February it was 59.9, now it's 59.6, so it's down three ticks.
And you and I are, I mean, all the numbers that we blur everybody's brain with, including our own, I think you and I and Kevin and everybody agrees that somehow health in this country is 62, 63, maybe even 63 and a half, 64 on that number. 59.9 right. Is not going to cut it.
No, and it's there's a bunch of issues that come up. Anytime you have economic dislocations, you get an awful lot of people that permanently go on disability that aren't really disabled. Okay, they're able to work, but they're able to qualify through whatever machination, and they choose to not. It's not that they can't, it's that they choose not to. Maybe they lose their job, but they had a job, but they didn't all of a sudden have a heart attack, okay? They, for economic reasons, they decided that this was the better choice. And then having made that decision, it almost never is the case that they come off those rolls.
And some people are not they can't come off them. Some people have.
Well, some people. That's true, Chief. But the point is this: that there is a inflection point every time we have a recession, right? And this is in the data that goes all. I mean, I don't care how far back you go, you'll find it all the way back.
It never changes.
SSDI being first introduced. Every time there's been a recession, this number spikes. There is no way that the recession causes somebody to become disabled. Okay, that's not what happens. So there is leakage within the system that can be exploited, and at the margin there is a point where you will seek it rather than to work. All right? The problem isn't that, because if that was reversed when the economy turned around, it wouldn't be a big issue. The problem is, once it happens for somebody, it almost never changes. And that is a huge issue, because recessions happen. Bad economic times happen. And you can't continue to ratchet higher this, you know, this situation where you're getting paid to sit around chuck beer bottles out the window.
Well, I mean, there's that, but there's also, and I go back to, I mean, how can I say this charitably? I'm a little more charitable sometimes, and some of my guests, but there are some people, when recessions happen, and it looks like, well, you and I think probably in agreement that a big chunk of society has been in one for like a really long time, the ability to, you know, it's just like the people, the The governor of Virginia was on there talking about, we've got all these job openings. Well, first of all, I think a lot of those are fake.
Right.
Because I think people are just looking for people that are willing to work for less than they're paying other people. But that's another story. I don't have a proof of that. Except Dan Janita's buddy actually went around one day and called all the numbers, and nobody answered the phone. All these places.
Oh, well, there you go.
But but that's a small sample. But the gentleman, and I wish I could find this. You're good at this. The guy who wrote that Pulitzer Prize thing for Washington Post, was, we talked about the Horseshoe of Despair.
Yeah.
He's talking about this lady who was on, there's a county in Alabama where an awful lot of people are on long-term disability, which essentially is a new unemployment.
Yeah.
They're interviewing this lady, and she worked in a nursing home
since
she was like 18. Well, guess what? She's 50, and she's got back issues. Well, duh.
Right, well, duh. Yeah. Well, I wonder how that happened.
And,
right.
And because there's, you know, a lot of people don't have the thing where you get the people out of bed.
What, you don't have the lift, right.
And she goes, I can take a job tomorrow if I can find some place where I'm sitting down. She goes, I don't know one person in my group that I know, any of my friends, that has ever had a job sitting down.
Right.
Now,
well, that,
if the economy was good, somebody would say, because obviously she showed up to work every day to do the work she was doing. If the economy was good, you'd say, come on over here for 3 months, we'll retrain you, we'll do this stuff.
Oh,
she didn't want to be able. But
well, listen, I had people in my customer service department that, you know, you didn't have to have a college degree to do that job. Okay, you had to be able to drive a computer, but I could train you how to use the software and handle the phone calls. If I had a company that had an office there that had that kind of, I'd hire somebody like that. She shows up every day, she does the job, she goes home. What's not to like about that?
Yeah, I'm saying some of the stuff that we assume there's always a certain amount you get laid off of this job, but oh, by the way, my nephew's machinery company is hiring guys, and if they're going to train you, which most companies don't anymore now, they're not into that. But if they did, okay, you're off for a few weeks, and you go over there and you change careers and something, something. But I think it's getting harder and harder to slip like that. I mean, there's no way this lady's going to end up in Topeka, Kansas tomorrow because she heard there's jobs there. I mean,
I understand that. But look, we were talking about impending recession, right? Well, who loses their job first when a recession starts?
This time it seems to be the government, but usually not.
Well, but I mean, in the civilian workforce, who loses their job first?
Well, usually the people in the hospitality and those kinds of places,
and people with less education.
Yeah.
Right. Well, guess what? Participation rate among less than a high school diploma down 8 ticks among those with a high school graduate, but not a college degree, down 6 ticks, and for those who have an associate's or a bachelor's, both up a little bit, both up some. So the bifurcation that you normally see in a rollover is in the data this month.
What's your number with the hourly wages versus paycheck? Did you look
at
that?
Well, I'm looking for that. And then the other one I want to look at is what they say is for government job ads, which I didn't look at originally because I was, keying things in and digging through some of this other stuff. Okay, so hours worked, total private is flat. It's an unch, both for goods and service producing, which is rather interesting. In aggregate,
that's kind of unusual, isn't it, for this to be unch like that?
That is very unusual for them both to be unch, but it was unch. Now, that means, though, no improvement. I mean, it also means, it didn't all go to hell, right? So average, total private, average weekly earnings, as you'd expect, were up enough to buy half a dozen eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Yeah, not much. About $4. And let's see, goods producing was up a little more. Service producer, well, service is mostly economy. Service producing was up about four, a little less than $4. And leisure and hospitality, surprisingly, was actually, did have about the same, I mean, on a dollars basis, and since they get paid less on a percentage basis, that was a better improvement. So, I don't see anything in here in this table, in the average hourly earnings and you know, in hours, I don't see anything here that looks, you know, like the bottom's about to fall out of the barrel. You know, I'm seeing small increases in the, you know, in the hourly earnings and in the weekly checks. So I mean, not enough to keep up with the actual inflation rate, though, which is of course a problem, because, you know, what are you going to do there, right? I mean, that's a huge issue. But yeah, I mean, it's the index of aggregate hours and payrolls, small positive numbers. I don't see much in the way of negatives. Construction's down a little bit February. That's normal. It's cold. People, you're not digging holes in the ground when it's 30 below zero, and February's still winter. So that is a expected thing. And I just don't see anything there that looks like a particular problem. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting is that federal government employment declined. Really?
Yeah.
It says that. Gee, it did. You mean they fired some of the people that they fired actually showed up in the data this month. A big shock, right? But let's see. We've got government decline. All right. Where is it? Decline by 10. Oh, gee. Doji is doing such great things, Chief. I'm telling you, this is the biggest thing in the world. A whole 10,000 people in the federal government lost their jobs.
Well, I mean, I was surprised when I went through the numbers.
Well, if you're one of them, it's a depression, yeah, right? I mean, that's the difference, the definitional difference.
I was surprised when I went through the whole numbers. Well, again, from the... You know what? I don't want to ask you. I got these numbers from the I think it's from the Fed. I don't know where it's from. How many government employees there are.
Right.
Why at the end of every year do they spike up? Do they hire people in December for some reason?
Oh, there's... it's probably the adjustment month. I haven't dug into the Fed's methodology, but they probably do an annual rebase just like the BLS does. I would have to believe they do. On the other hand, there's a few things that I think are kind of interesting with all this this stuff. I'm sure you I don't know if you listened to Trump's speech the other night or not.
Well, I did.
Well, I did.
Mercifully, I fell asleep about two thirds of the way through.
Well, I did live commentary on Rumble during it. I did the Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of commentary on it, where basically I was guffawing at him the entire time and drinking whenever he said certain things, because we have a little drinking game with us. So it stayed in the
God, you'd be probably plastered.
Well, I was pretty. The next morning was a pretty decent headbanger. I needed a couple of espresso shots to knock that down. But the thing that it was interesting was that one of the segments he did in that speech was he went through the things that Doji had identified and eliminated. Okay. You know what? Only one of them had a B for a billion.
Yeah.
And the rest were M's for millions. And the B, by the way, was a single digit B. And I'm like, okay, we're 2,000 billion in the hole every year at this point, right? Which is directly the source of inflation, and you're telling me that you're taking a victory lap over the fact that you found 1% of that.
Yeah, that's been my railing bitch on this whole thing all the way through.
I'm saying, Chief, look, you want to know one of the places where they could take a meat axe to things and it would actually make a huge difference right now is this stuff with PBMs, okay? So PBMs have a rather curious little distortion that they managed to get into the system, which is that whatever they tell CMS, Medicare and Medicaid, the retail price of a drug is, CMS has to accept this. So if they, for example, say... you're paying, through the PBM, you're paying $1,600 a month for this prescription for each person that has it, 30-day supply. And by the way, that's a good deal because the retail price is $2,000. So you're getting a pretty decent discount off the retail price, right? But the truth is that I can walk into a different pharmacy with no insurance whatsoever and I can buy the drug for $60. And... this is blatant fraud It is racketeering because you have multiple entities involved in it. All right. So we are talking about racketeering here. The fact that the law gives the PBM the ability to say this and denies CMS the ability to audit it does not change the fact that it is still racketeering and it is still fraud. So if you were to go after that sort of thing, I mean, Medicare Part D, and it's just as bad as in Medicaid, but there's no way, it's not broken out in the MTS. So I don't know what the number is in Medicaid, but in Medicare I do. From the point that Obamacare came in to today, Medicare Part D spending has doubled. And virtually, and by the way, when Obamacare came in, Medicare Part D exploded higher. It used to be about $30 billion and went to 50 in the space of about a year and a half. Now it's over 100. If you wanted to take real chunks out of this stuff, that is low-hanging fruit. That's real easy.
And you just tell people it's not easy because they're paying people off.
Well, yeah, it is. You tell them you cut this crap out or you're going to prison.
Well, but it's that the people who are getting fired right now, first of all, the ones that voted for Trump three times are outraged.
Aww.
But I had this long conversation with somebody the other day because the person went to the local Walgreens and is on Eliquis, right?
Right.
You know, Eliquis is a blood thinner for people who don't know. There's
right.
The old one was the rat poison.
Warfarin.
But
which, by the way, is rat poison.
It is rat poison. It's also how they killed Stalin, by the way.
Well, but in small amount. I mean, my dad was on it in small amount because he had phlebitis, which
it's a pain in the ass. You got to keep going getting tested.
Well, yeah, because if it goes too high, it kills you.
Well, then they come up with this Eliquis and this whatever the other one was. There's another one that's I'll think Xarelto. So these are the miracle ones that you don't have to go get tested, but they're incredibly expensive. Now they cost, one of my research, they cost $18 a year to produce, and the list price is roughly $700 a month.
Right.
So
right.
So Medicare is going to pay so $700 a month times 12 is like $10,000.
Yeah.
So Medicare is going to pay Part D. It's probably going to pay $6,000. You're paying three with the deductibles. Say they're paying $6,500. Okay, now if that's $6,500 for the million people,
that's a lot of money
that are on this thing. And I'm sure the other one, Xarelto, is the same way. Trump could save one hell of a lot of money saying, "Hey, $18. What is the story here, guys? I mean, we're going to give you 50, not $10,000. I mean, well, that's like real money,
Chief. This is the basic problem, and it's the reason that if Trump and as I have said, I said this before he was inaugurated back in my annual look forward, my predictions ticker. He's got till the end of March, and if he doesn't go after this and pull the rug on this thing, and yeah, it's going to generate a huge recession because, hello, when you take that kind of money out of the system, somebody gets screwed, right?
I mean, without jumping in immediately and vilifying Biden, one of the drugs that he had on his list to negotiate a Medicare 3.5 years ago, 3 years ago when he still had some marbles, was Eliquis and Xarelto.
Right.
Where did the bureaucracy, the Congress, where did that go? No place. When the dude at one point was charged up to do it. Now he didn't complete it, but why, no matter who it is, whether, I mean, and we're, the odd part about the Trumpers, and I know you're not a big Trumper, but the odd part about the Trumpers is they gloss over the fact that the dude was there for 4 years.
Oh, absolutely. And oh, by the way, not only was he there for 4 years, in his first campaign, he said he was going to fix all of this. And on election night in 2016, it disappeared literally seconds after the election was called for him.
Why can't it happen? Somewhere in the law, there's got to be someplace somewhere that says just because you have a 15 or 16-year-old patent, you can't charge, 100 times what you make.
Chief, the problem is not that. The problem is it is endemic in the way that we do this within the United States. Okay, in order for you to get a drug approved, and this is, and again, this is a regulatory problem, and it's, but it's fixable. The problem with fixing it is Congress has to fix it.
I know you were going with this. We don't have that much time. Can I jump in real quick and say?
Well, go, let me give you the 30
second.
I'm going to
say before you even start. Bull bleep. They spent more on advertising the damn thing in the last month than they did to develop it 17 years ago.
I understand that, but that's not the point. The reason this stuff happens is that in order to get a drug approved, you do not have to show that it is better than the existing one. You just have to show that it works better than nothing. Therefore, I can shop these things that are on patent instead of the one that isn't. And then I put the advertising out there, and now I got every single person with that condition banging on their doctor demanding that they get the new one, even though it isn't any better than the old one.
Well, it is a little better. You have to go get tested.
Well, excuse me. Yeah. There are some serious side effects that come up from these
newer...
Sure
there is. Sure there is.
And the only way you can detect them is, again, to do the testing, right? So every drug has bad effects. Every drug has risks. But the thing is this, at some point, if we actually had a market and you had to pay, then you would look at this and say, this one's $20 a month and I can pay it. This one's $600 a month.
Well, you do have to pay. Your deductible is like $3,000 to $4,000.
Well, now, wait a minute. But if I'm on Medicare and I'm on Part D, then a lot of that is, you know, once I hit that cap, I don't pay any of it.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
The copay is the same for both. By the way,
no, you pay. I don't know the full numbers, but it changed this year. But you paid the first $590 out of pocket, which is a lot for somebody. I bet you could do some numbers and say that's why older people don't have any money in January.
Well, if you're on Chief, if you're on Advantage, this is not necessarily true.
It's $590.
All right.
And then it goes down, and then you reach the donut hole.
Right.
And then after
I know. There's all kinds of, and then you've got the supplement plans, but it depends on which part of this you're on.
Right.
Okay?
It's a big mess. Hey, I got a quick one for you. You'll never guess I'm going to say this, because I'm, you know, you guys always got me on the liberal side, which I'm really not. Last night, one of my buddies that I usually give a ride home to, him, he wasn't feeling so hot, so I left home. I'm going early by myself, and I'm listening to radio. They got this lady on there. This is out of your wildest dreams. Kevin's gonna have a grabber when I say this. So I don't want to have Kevin having a grabber, but they got some lady on there, and she's doing research into teenagers. And I'm sitting there going, "What is she friggin' talking about?" Teenagers need 8.5 to 9 hours sleep at night.
Right.
No, I never did, but that's a story.
Well, I never got it, but yeah.
Yeah, I never. And so, she's from California. Go figure. And she's decided that she went through all the public schools, and now there's a mandate you're gonna not start high schools till like 9:30 or 10 o'clock.
Oh God!
So the teenagers can get the sleep they want, and she's going to other states and trying to sell the same thing. And I'm sitting there going, if school starts at 8 and you need 9 hours sleep, you're supposed to do the counting, not the school. what am I missing here? Plus, If Marist would have started at 10 o'clock, how would I have gotten there? Because the rush hour buses ran at 8. And she's actually making this massive progress, and she is so dedicated. I'm like, what are you talking about? You figure out whatever the time is, figure out how much you have to sleep, and it's up to you to get there on time. What am I missing?
It's when you go to bed, right?
I got to play video games at 12. I need 9 hours sleep so you can't start school to 10. I mean, where did this lady get the money for this study?
The same place that they got the ones that said that transitioning people was good, and now we've got the proof that in fact what it actually does is double the rate of serious depression and suicide.
Yeah, my quick one that I never got the.
By the way, as if that insanity isn't enough, you want the one that just hit the tape last night? So, Trump has signed an EO. That is establishing a strategic Bitcoin reserve.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. I didn't even want to think about it.
By the way, guess where he's getting the Bitcoin? All the ones that they seized from Silk Road.
Okay. Who's going to run it, his kid?
Well, no, it's the way the order is structured. It is not going to be sold. Okay? It's going to be sat on. But here's the problem with this. The way this order is structured, the only way that it can acquire more is to seize more. So now you just gave the government a reason to steal your cryptocurrency.
These people,
because they get to stash it in the treasury.
These people are on some kind of roids. I mean,
this is insane.
Sure it is. But it's we have a guy in there who's actively working his own portfolio. That's all he's
done. You know what, though? That's not going to help the price of Bitcoin. It's going to do the exact opposite.
It's down today. It's down huge today.
Well, actually, at the moment, it's plus 0.3%.
Okay, it was down an hour ago.
No, it was down an hour ago, I know. But here, dig this, one sentence out of this order. The United States government currently holds a significant amount of BTC. Yeah, because we seized it. But has not implemented a policy to maximize BTC's strategic position as a unique store of value in the global financial system.
I have a quick question for you.
I stole it by judicial fiat, and now I'm going to try to maximize the value of what I stole.
If they raid your house and kill you because you fight back,
right?
How do they get your Bitcoin without your password?
Because the anyone that thinks, well, if it's on an exchange, they get it because the exchange has it actually. But here's the bigger,
you can actually put Bitcoin in. I use the term what they use for stocks. It's under house name.
Well, in order for you to transact, you have to put it on an exchange at least temporarily. So if you are buying and selling it. You know, I mean, in the days of old, Chief.
So it's essentially street name, like in stock.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the days of old, I had physical stock certificates for my dad.
I understand, but I'm saying, yeah. But now we'll talk about this on Tuesday, because people don't know what street name means. But they have your password for the, if you put it on deposit, you got to give them your password.
Well, you don't give them your password. You transfer the Bitcoin to them.
Oh, okay.
So but it's held under your account.
So it's in street name. All right.
It's just like holding it in street name, essentially.
So they have the password.
Their system. But this is how that exchange in Korea got hacked.
Let's go into this on Tuesday.
Yeah.
SP Futures down 11. NASDAQ Futures down 23. First, we came up a little bit on this. I've got the 30. Interest rates are down pretty heavy. They're 10 years at 4.22. So.
The spread has compressed as well. The IRX is only down a tenth of a point of a percent, but the TNX is down 1.6%.
Yep.
So the spread's come down quite a bit. It's down substantially.
All right, have a nice weekend, bud. We'll talk on Tuesday.
Yeah.